Hello, everyone. I am here with Gina Lake. Gina, would you like to say hi?
Hi, everybody. Nice to be here.
Yeah, and they're saying hello, Gina and Gina, in the room. They can type in the room as well. And they're saying hello, Gina and Gina, because although Regina is my birth name, of course, many people call me Gina. So.
Another thing we have in common.
In fact, one of the things that you said to me when I wrote and invited you this evening, and you wrote back and you said you looked and we have a lot of things in common. And, of course, I didn't know exactly what you meant by that until I started watching your Buddha at the Gas Pump interview. And then I saw what maybe you meant by that. I saw that your experience of learning inner wisdom, of realizing inner wisdom, began much in the same way as my experience, which was what a lot of people would call channeling. I never used that particular word, but it was the hearing of an inner voice. I felt like the student listening to an other that was coming from within, and yours really started the same way. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And back then in 1986, it was called channeling, and it still is, but that's become a bit of a dirty word, it seems. I don't know why, but maybe just because there are different kinds of channeling, and sometimes you don't always reach the highest, best beings up there, but isn't that the case with everything? There's a high side and a low side to all of it.
Yeah, yeah. You were kind enough to share one of your books with me. It was the one called The Jesus Trilogy, and Jesus is the voice of that book, true?
Yes, it is true. Uh-huh.
So how did...
That's been a more recent development. Just over the last 2 years, I was contacted by both Mary and Jesus. First Mary and then Jesus, after a certain spiritual shift that I experienced. And that was something that was rather surprising to me, because at that point I had put the idea that I channel in the background, and it wasn't anywhere on my website, really. I wasn't hiding it purposely. If people would ask or I would explain, I just didn't put it out front and center, and it was such a relief. It was so comfortable, because there's a certain amount of negative feedback that you get as a channel, especially in the field of non-duality. Which is ironic, right? That non-duality somehow doesn't include channeling in the non-duality. So, because I'm married to an invited teacher, and because that was the background I'm teaching through recently, it was uncomfortable for a lot of people for me to say that I channel and to feel good about that.
Well, and probably also channeling Jesus. I mean, that's, for some, that would be even a little more unacceptable, right?
Well, I think that I've come to peace with that I'm not strictly this non-dual Advaita teacher. I started to realize at a certain point a few years ago that really wasn't my place, that somehow I'm more like a bridge between the non-dual community and maybe what you'd call New Age, or just any other aspect of spirituality, a more broad base. And I discovered that what I write is very resonant with A Course in Miracles people, are your people too.
Yeah, that's primarily who's in this room right now. So at least that's their baseline, their foundation. Not necessarily the only thing, but yes.
Yeah, and I didn't know very much about A Course in Miracles at all, but I started to look into it once I heard that so many people on Facebook were responding and resonating with what I was writing. I thought, people were telling me that what I write is a lot like A Course in Miracles. So I had to go look into that a little bit, and sure enough, It is. And that, but that was all before Jesus showed up. And then, so then I thought, oh, great. Well, now Jesus is here. And now what will A Course in Miracle people think? I'm not trying to, be something, you know.
No,
that,
I just want to say.
Helen Schuchman or something, but
yeah.
yeah. I'm not trying to be anything, really. I'm just doing what I'm asked to do, and it just has always felt right. And when Jesus appeared and asked me to write this book, it was a choiceless choice.
Yeah.
I just, there was just no question at this point in my life, in my channeling career, in my spiritual development, that I would say no to that. There was no question. But it did kind of throw me, because it did throw me back into the idea that I'm a channel and having to put that out in the public again. And so here I had it in the background, which is what I was starting to say, is I had it all tucked away in the background so comfortably. And then when I these books came through, I actually asked Jesus and Mary if I could put them out in another voice, in my voice. Please, please. And they said no.
Well, you know, one of the things I heard you talking about in the Buddha at the gas pump interview was how subtle self-identity keeps trying to come back. And, you know, like self-identity can be I'm a channel. Self-identity can also be I'm not a channel.
Oh, yeah, it's so tricky. It's so tricky.
But I'm nothing, I'm empty, and I am, you know, whatever is occurring right now is a really good place to stand. So, you know, maybe sometimes channeling is happening and maybe sometimes it's not. But I do want to say to the people in the room that I haven't read all of this book. Gina shared this book with me about half a week ago or so, and so I haven't read all of this book. It's called The Jesus Trilogy. But I have read some of it, probably about 90 pages of it, and I really enjoy it. I think it's a very, very good book, very simply written. In fact, every now and then somebody will complain a little bit about A Course in Miracles and how difficult it is for them to understand because of the language. Gina's book is very simple to read, very easy to understand. Very, very, very clear. I just can't find anything to say, uh-oh, watch out for this part. I can't find that in there, not yet anyway. So I do want to recommend her book, The Jesus Trilogy. Also, Gina, you, another thing that we have in common, I don't know if you know, but you kind of started non-dual, and then Jesus shows up, so you're crossing over maybe into A Course in Miracles. I started in A Course in Miracles, and then Ramana Maharshi showed up in me, and I kind of crossed over. So it's funny. That, go ahead.
Well, there must be a need for some bridging.
I think so. I think that one of the weaknesses in spirituality sometimes can be fundamentalism. Whether you're a fundamentalist Course in Miracles or a fundamentalist non-dual or a fundamentalist Buddhism, it's one of the way the ego continues to separate.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we start a little bit at the beginning, because some of the people in the room might not know you at all. So, and by the beginning in this case, what I really mean is your awakening experience. We don't need to go back too far, because I'm really more interested in your teachings than your story. But a little bit about your awakening experience and what followed that would be interesting.
Okay, sure. I'm not sure that it's a very dramatic or interesting experience compared to some people's, but it is what it is, and I'm very grateful that I had it, and it was very life-changing for me. Leading up to the awakening that I had been a very serious meditator and spiritual seeker, I guess you would say, but I also was a spiritual counselor for many years as an astrologer. And so I was a meditator, meditating 2 hours a day for 12 years or so, and spending a lot of time doing inner work with the being that would work with me. And so there was a lot of almost like therapy going on, and healing work, and insight, and understanding. So my life about 15 years prior to awakening was extremely immersed in spirituality, and I didn't have any outside job or anything like that. So it was very dedicated, and I would have wonderful meditations, but then I would come out of my meditation, and there the me was again with all its issues and struggling and complaints or whatever. And so the miracle of awakening is that it flipped my identity to what I experienced myself as in meditation. So that's how I would describe it, is that before awakening I was the me, and in meditation I experienced my higher self, which is the term I used to use for it. And it seemed like the higher self was something out there, you know, something that you would experience sort of separate from yourself out there. And after awakening, my identity shifted so that what I now experienced as myself was what I experienced in meditation. And it seemed that the me that was my usual former identity was more like a pile of clothes on the floor. It's like I stepped out of it and I couldn't find it anymore. And so much dropped away. And but of course a lot still remained. It's all kind of relative. And as I can see farther down the road, I'm 15 years or 16 years down the road from this moment of awakening, which was in 1999. Over that course of that 16 years, I can see that I'm just kind of guessing at these figures, but I think that maybe I dropped about 60% of my conditioning in 1999.
Okay.
But it felt like it was much more than that. It was so freeing. But I could see over the years that there still was quite a lot of conditioning that remained. And this is true, I think, of most people after an awakening. There still is conditioning that needs to get seen, healed, and released. And so over the course of these 15, 16 years, I'm guessing now that I'm really at a pretty low percentage. But then again, who knows? Because before I thought I was too. So... But that's kind of interesting to me. It seems that more recently, just the last couple of years, I've had a real deepening, and I can see that I'm much freer than I was. But I felt very free in 1999, and I moved into quite a honeymoon period for that first year. And during that year, after I awakened, I also met Nirmala. Actually, I met him 2 weeks after I awakened. And began to fall in love with him. He was he was giving satsang in my area when I met him, and I had just woken up, and I was very interested in knowing more awake people. I didn't really know many at all, and I wondered, well, what would it be like to be in a relationship with someone else who's awake? So I was very curious, and I tracked him down, and I said, can we get together? We ended up talking on the phone because he was traveling, and so we began a relationship over the phone for that year. But it was quite a wonderful year, being both in love and newly awake. And I have to say now, looking back on that, there was a lot of identity around I'm awake, which there was some remnant of ego that was thrilled about I'm awake. And yet that doesn't diminish the truth of the experience. The reality of the experience was that I moved into a place where I knew I was awareness all the time. And it was permanent. I would contract at times when some conditioning might get triggered, but it was never contracting or suffering in the way previous to awakening. It was different. It was much easier. It was much shorter, less difficult to see. I could see it right away. I knew it immediately. So it's quite a boon to have the awakening, because you can get through your conditioning, you can release it and heal it much more quickly than before awakening, because you're able to see it and just look at it, witness it, and not, it doesn't feel like this horrible thing. You just see it for what it is. So it doesn't have the power that it used to have. So that's a very long answer to your question about my awakening experience. I don't know if I covered what you wanted.
Yeah, that sounds perfect. And in fact, it's brought up two more questions. Hopefully I can remember both of them long enough. The first question that it brought up for me was, prior to this awakening experience, and I understand that awakening experiences happen through grace, but at the same time, what do you feel that you were doing that most prepared you for this awakening experience? If somebody else is still on the other side of the line and they're saying, what do I do? What do I do? What's the answer to that question?
I think meditation is primary. I think it is so important. And I was meditating a lot. And when I wasn't meditating, I was also running to music, riding my bike to music. I was tranced out a lot of the time. So I wasn't spending time lost in my egoic thoughts. I was spending a lot of time in a more expanded state by walking in nature, and I spent a lot of time by myself also. So I wasn't dissipating my energy through a lot of chatter and involvement in emotional or negative relationships or that kind of thing. I've always been a bit of a hermit, and I think that's can be helpful. Of course, relationships are important in bringing up our stuff, but I just was very, I think the desire to awaken is also key. But then again, that's grace, isn't it? Because
I think so.
Where does the desire to awaken come from? Where does the will to do meditation come from? It's actually all grace. And maybe the ego gets in there if it hears about spirituality and it wants to awaken for its own reasons. That might go on. But for a lot of us, the whole spiritual path and the energy and effort behind it is coming from grace, is coming from our deepest self. And so I think that when people feel very strongly that they want to awaken and they're willing to do practices and go to satsang and do the things that we spiritual people do, heal ourselves. When all of that willingness is there, I think that's a very good sign.
Okay, well, I have another question, even before my other one that I already have. Your meditation. Can you tell us, what type of meditation, what kind of meditative practice that you had?
Yes. I had a hard time meditating in silence from the start. I'm not sure why. I have a busy mind, and I found early on that I really love to meditate to music. So, and it wasn't letting my mind wander while the music is in the background. It was a focused meditation on sound, which is a legitimate meditation. And I can see now that it was very valuable. I think I used to feel a little apologetic about it, like I was cheating to meditate to music. But I think it really trained my mind to focus. And the other thing that trained my mind to focus was simply all the writing and the channeling that I was doing, because you can't be thinking and channeling.
Right.
You can't be thinking and writing at the same time. You're focused, and your mind is very focused. And so I think anything that really focuses the mind is going to be helpful. Because I meet a lot of people who I can see their only problem is they didn't really learn ever to focus their mind in their daily life or in meditation, that they actually just can't keep their mind one-pointed for very long. And so you can learn to focus the mind just by doing a lot of things that require that, not just even meditation. So anyhow, listening to music, focusing on sound was the way that I used to focus my mind. And so it was just very simple. Whenever the mind wandered, I would bring it back to the sound. And I found that after a while, I really merged with the music. And so the other thing that that accomplished is it trained my brain a certain way so that as soon as I would hear some notes or a certain, it wouldn't even have to be a certain song that I meditated to, it could just be music, my mind would go into that state. Mm-hmm. It would go into that place of quiet. So so with meditation, we really are training the brain. And so whatever works, and that's what I tell people is, really everybody needs to just find the way to meditate that they enjoy so that they'll do it, because that's the most important thing, doing it every single day and at least an hour. Because now so many people just say, oh, meditate for 20 minutes or half an hour. But the body mind just starts to settle then, and you don't really get the full effect, the deepening, the real reward of meditation until probably 45 minutes in for most people. That certainly was true for me. And so I think that's another key is that it yes, meditation can be really hard at first because the mind wants to do what it wants to do and it hasn't had to be disciplined. But it's really, really valuable to stick with it longer so that you drop into that place of quiet, which is the reward of meditation. And when your meditations are rewarding, then you're going to do them. Yeah. And you're going to do them more and more. And now, these days, I do meditate, but it's more like I meditated. It's more like I close my eyes and something takes over energetically and pulls me into meditation. And I would say that's the reward of having made an effort to meditate over so many years, is that when your meditation gets to that point where you're meditated, where it's no effort any longer and you're just pulled into meditation and it's completely pleasurable and effortless, that's why I meditated all those other years.
Yeah.
That was what it was meant to get to, is what I'm experiencing now in meditation is the real meditation, really. It's the real dropping into the deepest place and then going deeper and deeper within yourself. And when meditations are that deep, they change you throughout your day. And even the other meditations prior to that, all those other years, they certainly did make me generally more calm and peaceful. But there's something that's going on now these days with these very deep meditations that are effortless that is affecting me on a very deep level, moment to moment throughout my day. And but it's of a different quality. So I think it's really exciting to know that this unfoldment, it just keeps going deeper and it keeps on going. And it gets easier, it gets better, it's really worthwhile. And no matter how long it takes, it's worth it. Or no matter what effort it takes, it's worth it. For one thing, what's the alternative? The alternative isn't so great.
Yes. Yes. Well, and somebody has asked a question in the room. They typed in the question. They said, where did you go for satsang? Because you mentioned the satsangs prior to the awakening.
Well, I was fortunate enough to live in Marin County in California. And that is where Ajahn Chanti's community is. And it's also where that San Francisco Bay Area is also where in during that time in the late 90s, and I'm sure it's still happening now, the circuit of satsang teachers all come through there. They travel to certain places like Boulder and Portland and Seattle and Boston and Santa Fe. There are certain places in this country where the satsang teachers, I think maybe they go more places than they used to, but back then in the 90s, those were the places. In San Francisco Bay Area was one of those special places. The consciousness there is so high. There's so many people who are really dedicated to spirituality. It was really wonderful. And so there was always satsang going on.
Okay, good. Let me glance and see if there's any other questions. All right, I don't see any other questions yet. And by the way, if anybody has a question, you can type it on the board. I might miss it. You can also put up your hand, and I'll turn the mic over to you, and you can ask Gina directly. Although this frequently turns out to appear to be me interviewing whoever our satsang guest is, it was really originally intended to give you an opportunity to ask your questions of our guest while our guest is here. So if a question occurs to you, do not be afraid to put your hand up. I'm sure Gina would love to hear other voices besides mine. So my other question that I had, which you kind of partially, I think, have answered, but I will ask it anyway to see if there's more. I originally asked you about any practices that maybe led up to your awakening experience. And then you mentioned during your awakening experience, an imaginary number, but maybe 60% of your conditioning just fell away. But, of course, that leaves 40%. So is there any kind of practice that you engaged in post-awakening in order to continue blossoming in awakening?
I think probably inquiry in my own sort of casual personal way that I used it is something I still use today. It is one of the most basic practices, I think. And by inquiry, I just mean asking questions. What did I just believe? What thoughts just ran through my head that I just believed? Or what is this feeling all about? What's at the base of this feeling? That kind of simple inquiry into any contracted experience that I'm having. Of course, I have the resource of channeling, so I would ask the being that I work with sometimes if I was caught up in a feeling or a contracted sense, I would have a dialogue with this being, and he had a way of leading me like I would with my spiritual mentoring clients, like I do these days when I do counseling. He had a way of leading me into seeing the root issue and just saying something that would shift the whole perspective. So I think that the other maybe technique or practice would be learning how to reframe our experience, because that's what this being was doing with me. He would find a way to look at it other than how my mind and ego was looking at a situation which was causing pain. He would bring in a different perspective, the broader, truer, more real perspective, the perspective of essence or the true self. And that's a powerful thing, because really, in order to move out of our contractions, all we really need to do is to see something differently, because we're contracted because we're believing a lie. We're believing a mistaken idea, a belief that we have, that we acquired from our conditioning. And so we just need to see the lie. And then, of course, seeing the truth is a way of counteracting that. So there's a way of stepping back from your experience, back, far enough so that you have this broader perspective, which is, you could say, the perspective of your soul, of your true self, of essence, and which is always positive, right? The perspective of our soul is always positive. There's always a positive story we can tell about our experience. But the mind and the ego, the egoic mind, tells a negative story, a very small and limiting story. So we just have to see that that story is being told and that it's a lie and that it's limiting, and find a different story to tell, find the true story. And so the being that I would work with would help me to find the truer story. But that's something that anybody can do within themselves if they're willing to do it and if they know enough to do it. So I would say that's really what I do, is I ask some questions about, oh, what's going on here? What did I just believe? Where, you know, what is this feeling all about? And feel into it. And then see that whatever I'm believing isn't true. Now, I would also want to add that doing this inquiry and this these exercises with some beliefs and some feelings might not necessarily instantly make them disappear. I think it's really important for us to be gentle with ourselves and to realize that it's difficult to be a human being, and that some of these emotional issues have to just run their course. They're like a storm that is blowing through, and we don't want to feed the storm, but sometimes we can't do anything to particularly make it go away. All we can do is not make it worse. So we do what we can to not make it worse, to just let it be and accept it and be gentle with ourselves and know that it will pass. And I'm saying this because I have a family history of depression. That's something that's been in my family. It's the reason I got on the spiritual path. And I would say that these days I don't really have many emotions. I don't really feel anger particularly. I might feel irritation. I don't feel strong emotions like I used to, but so my conditioning these days looks like a dark cloud coming in, and it's not very specific, but I recognize it as probably being that old depression that used to come in really heavily and stay for a long time. Now it's more like a little white cloud that in a blue sky. It's not very strong, it's not very dark, but it's still there, and it still needs its time to dissipate. And so I think that's the progress that one can see on the path, that the emotions are less strong, they're less difficult to deal with, they last a much less time, and eventually they are not particularly formidable. But I think it's important that people understand that even after awakening, for most people, and I know a lot of spiritual teachers and a lot of people who've had awakenings, for most people, they're still our emotions. There still are difficult moments, challenging times that people can experience after awakening. It's just easier to deal with them. But the emotions do decrease quite a lot over time. But then again, I'm 16 years into it, you know, and I'm very dedicated in my life to my spirituality because it's, you know, it's my work. It's my life. I live with someone whose work and life, it also is that. So even under the best of circumstances, such as I'm living, it's still possible to feel emotions and to be contracted and, you know, there's still that human side of us. We're dual creatures, aren't we? We're the human side. What I'm seeing is the human side doesn't ever go away.
Yes.
And so it's a coexisting that we're doing with our humanity. Our divinity and our humanity are coexisting in every moment. And we have to be gentle with the human side of ourselves.
Well, someone has a question on the board, so I'm going to ask it, but then I have more questions, so then I'll be returning. But someone has a question on the board. It says, what did you mean by staying away from negative relationship? Did you say something about staying away from negative relationship? I've already lost that if you did.
I did.
Okay, what did you say then?
I don't remember what the context was, but I think it's very important to make good choices about who we spend our time with and how we spend our energy. I think that's a part of being on the spiritual path in a serious sort of way, is to not dissipate our energy in relationships with people who don't support us, people who are negative, people who are unhappy, people who don't I don't mean to be
I understand.
I don't mean to be judgmental. I'm just saying that it can be difficult to maintain our awakeness if we don't create circumstances in our life that support awakeness. And part of that is creating a lifestyle that has people in it who love you, who support you, who understand what's important to you and support that, support your values, and are not pulling you back into the egoic way of life.
Yes.
Most people are living a very egoic life. They don't understand or are interested in awakeness. If you're really interested in awakening and staying awake, it's important to surround yourself with people who are of that same interest. So it's very easy to get influenced by negativity, especially if you aren't very stabilized in your awakening.
Right.
And when people first wake up, they aren't very stabilized in their awakening. I've known people who had an awakening, but they weren't able to hold on to it in a sense. They weren't able to stay awake. It's almost like they never had an awakening because their jobs or their relationships were still the same old egoic stuff that brought them, pulled them back into their old way of being. And the ego reconstellated. And that can happen.
Yes.
And so, you know, sometimes spiritual people think, well, if I'm really spiritual, I should be able to do any kind of job or be in relationship or love anybody. And that's simply not, I mean, it may theoretically be true, but it isn't what your essence will choose. Your essence is going to choose a relationship that supports your evolution, and it's going to choose work that is in alignment with your life purpose. And so that you have to pay attention to the heart and to what life wants of you after awakening, or before awakening for that matter. The more aligned you are with what your soul came here to do, the more you are attuned intuitively to what your deepest self is moving you to do moment to moment, the happier you're going to be, and the more you'll be able to stay in that awake place. So, you know, part of being awake is being in alignment moment to moment with this that we are. And this that we are informs us of what it wants us to do in the world. And it informs us moment to moment. So it has, there's a reason for, if you awaken, there's a reason for you having awakened. And it will show you what that reason is. It will show you what it looks like. You won't know ahead of time. You just know moment to moment what it's supposed to look like. And you need to be willing to tune into that, to align with that, to do that. And some people aren't. Some people aren't willing to move out of circumstances that they've outgrown. It's difficult.
Well, and you're reminding me of some things that Jesus said in the Bible, which I think sometimes people say it's too strict. But, you know, he talks about those who leave family and fields for the kingdom of heaven, you know, will receive 10,000 times that or something like that. So, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, this path is not for the faint of heart, really. It's being very unconventional. You know, we find each other through the internet and, you know, through books and, you know, there's this wonderful community of people who are like-minded, but we're quite in the minority. We're very much in the minority. And, so particularly the United States is tremendously egoically driven. You know, the corporate atmosphere, businesses are all run very egoically. The values are, it's very hard to work within those environments, which are very dehumanizing, actually. So, you know, it's not that easy to follow your heart and be true to yourself within the conventional life.
Yes, well, I have another question that's going to seem like we're doubling back, but I wanted to honor this person's question on the board. So I want to go back to talking about depression a little bit. And part of the reason for this is I've been fortunate in this lifetime, in that although I definitely had an ego, a very strong ego, it's what we would call a healthy ego, in that I did not experience depression or OCD or any of these things that sometimes people say make it a little more challenging. And so you did experience depression, which I think is wonderful for some people, because some people still perceive that cloud of depression to be something that's just, it's too heavy. It's too heavy. And so I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit more for people who have maybe these additional challenges. Is there something you can share that might be helpful to them?
Psychotherapy. when I mentioned that I was depressed a lot when I was younger, and it got me on the path. Well, the path it got me on was getting a master's degree in psychology, in counseling psychology, because I knew I needed to heal myself. I wanted to learn to be happy. And I did all sorts of kinds of therapy. So that's very important. I think that meditation, as helpful as it is, it isn't enough for some people, and it's even a bypass. It's even, you know, what people call spiritual bypassing in some regards. For anyone who's had a difficult childhood, abuse especially, which I didn't have anything like that. I just had very unhappy parents who loved me very much. But that creates a lot of neurosis in a child. It's like, if my parents are this unhappy and this screwed up, what does that make me? So it was hard to feel good about myself when my parents, even though they thought I was wonderful, it was hard to feel good about myself when they didn't feel wonderful about themselves or each other. So psychotherapy is really important, and you have to find a way that works. And I back then when I was doing it, there were certain methods I mostly looked into more transpersonal things, and that's what I would recommend to people, more transpersonal kinds of psychotherapy that acknowledges the spiritual dimension, because otherwise it's mostly just working to improve the, to get a better false self, to get a better, a more functional ego is what generally psychology is about, is getting a more functional ego, not moving beyond the ego. But there is a transpersonal psychology which acknowledges that there is more beyond getting a better ego. So I don't know any way around that. It's hard work, but it's really worth it. And as I said earlier, what's the alternative? The alternative is not good.
Right. All right, let me see if there's any more questions on the board. Does anybody have anything they would like to ask Gina? We're about halfway through now, so it's a wonderful time. If she said something that sparked a question for you, or even if she hasn't said anything and there's something you're still curious about. If not, what I'll probably do is pull open my iPad and look at the Jesus Trilogy and find my own questions by looking at it. One thing, I have trouble asking questions sometimes because I understand the speaker so well, it doesn't create questions in me, if that makes any sense. It only creates agreement. But I do have your book right here, so let's see where we're at here. Let me open it up and just find a question. Let me check them again, though. I got to go back and forth here. I'm doing two things at once.
While you're doing that,
yes.
Why don't just say a little bit more about this, my books, because
okay,
I just
perfect.
Put a second book out by Jesus.
Oh.
Just released it. It's called A Heroic Life. Huh. And it uses the metaphor of a hero as the true self. All the heroic qualities, all the qualities we consider heroic, are qualities of our true nature. Courage, wisdom, patience, perseverance, inner strength, willingness to be disciplined and do what's hard for the greater good, this kind of thing. So the hero is our best self, and we all have that capacity within us to be the hero of our life. And the only thing that interferes with that is, of course, the egoic mind, the ego.
Yeah. Well, why don't we just talk a hair about that then? Sometimes I listen to teachers who are talking about what you might call being the hero of your life, and I can hear that they are talking about it from, I'm going to call it, a beyond me. Maybe, like in your book, the Jesus Trilogy, you talk about the little will, and I don't know if you call it the divine will or the thy will. And I can hear that they're talking about letting life live through them in a very joyous way. And then sometimes the people who are listening are still stuck in the little will. And they're trying to figure out how to make that work for me. I don't know. Can you talk a little bit about, what's the difference between being this hero in a really free way and still being stuck in the little will and trying to be the hero?
Well, that's what the little will does. It does try to be the hero. It tries to get what it wants, actually. More than it tries to be the hero. The little will is not really trying so much to be good. The little will is trying to get what it wants. And that's a big difference.
Yeah.
The hero has higher values. Values of unity, love, peace. But the little will's values are more power, more money, more security, more love from other people. It's not interested in loving. It's interested in getting love. So, the egoic values and goals are quite different from the heroic or true self's goals. And that's why it's hard to be happy from the level of the ego, because what it's going after are more superficial kinds of things that don't ultimately bring happiness. If you're trying to get happiness from things and from power, or even from a relationship, your other people can't make you happy. only you can make you happy. And so there are really two different ways of living life. You can either be following your mind's idea of what it needs to make your life work out, which is going to be, I need to get more money, I need to get a relationship, I need to look beautiful, I need to get thin, I need to buy a new car, I need to have a great house. Those are all the small self's ideas of how to get happy. And it's not to say that that we shouldn't go after those, or that those are not part of life. They are, of course, part of life. It's just that the ego assumes that that's where happiness lies. And those things aren't where happiness lies. Those things are part of life, and they make the world go round, but that isn't the deepest value. That isn't where true happiness is going to be found. And so the other way to live life is from your core, from your deepest self, which will move you moment to moment to do what is meaningful in that moment, and it will be very present to the people in your life, and the love will naturally flow from the people in your life, and that will be satisfying in and of itself. So, you know, the living life from your core, from your deepest self, is just naturally satisfying. So there's no question of being happy. You're already happy because being in the present moment is a place of happiness, because there is a connection with everything that you've ever wanted. When you're in the present moment, you're in touch with your natural love, peace, gratitude, awe and wonder about life, your natural clarity, your wisdom, all of the things that every human being wants is right there. We already have it.
Right.
We just have to go and tap into it and see that it's there. But those things are subtle. That kind of happiness is more subtle than the ego's happiness. It has to be focused on. And in order to be recognized, you have to turn your attention to it, to notice the love, to bring that out, to evoke it, to bring out the love, the peace that's there. Usually it's all covered over because we're lost in our thoughts, in our ideas about ourselves. So we're just out of touch with what's actually here right now in the present moment. Because we can only put our attention in one place at a time. So our attention, if it's in our head, in our thoughts, involved in the thought stream, we're going to be in the egoic world. The thought stream is the ego's world. There's no question about it. The thought stream, you don't have to go sorting through the thought stream to see what's divine and what's ego. It's all ego.
Okay? I love that. I love that, yeah. I want to repeat that. I love that so much. The thought stream is the ego's world. That's beautiful.
It is how the illusory world of the false self is created completely. And enlightenment is complete disregard of the thought stream.
Yeah.
Enlightenment is when the thought stream is no longer relevant. And you could say that the progress on the spiritual path from awakening to full enlightenment is about a lessening and lessening and lessening and lessening of thought, of the thought stream, and the strength of the thought stream, the compellingness of the thought stream, the relevance of it. So as you progress towards enlightenment, the thought stream falls farther and farther into the background until it's so irrelevant. It's like this murmur. It's like a murmur. It's like someone mumbling in the background. You just don't even want to bother to think those thoughts. You wouldn't even pick them up.
Right.
And so that's close to my experience. I can't say that every moment the thought stream is that distant. But even if it's quite loud or noticeable in my mind, I'm still really aware that it's the thought stream and not me. So So just to be clear, the thought stream is the egoic world, and it's the only thing that can keep us out of the present moment and out of contact with our true self, with our divine nature. And so the more we can learn to detach from our thoughts, that voice in our head, I'm not talking about the basic functional mind that we use to read or we use to follow a recipe. As a functional mind, it's like a tool we pick up and we use. That's not a problem at all. Our divine nature uses our intellect in life. But the thought stream is not that. The thought stream is irrational, and it's based mostly on the ego's sense of lack and fear and desires. Most of the thoughts that come through a person's mind, until they get cleaned up, because there is a certain amount of cleaning up that happens in the thought stream, the more healed we get. It can become more neutral, more positive. But most people's thoughts are quite negative.
Okay.
And
Okay, so I'm gonna ask you a few questions, and basically the moral of the story of each question is, which book should I read if this is where I'm at? Which one of your books should I read if this is where I'm at? Okay? So if I hate myself. You know, I think I'm fat. I think I'm ugly. I think I'm stupid. I'm constantly struggling with unworthiness, shame, self-hatred, and this is my condition. Which of your books should I read?
I would say go into psychotherapy, do some healing, and read any of my books.
Any of them.
Yeah. You know, I write, there's a certain similarity that runs through my books. And I think that I teach similar things but come at it from different directions and new ways of languaging it, because there's only so many ways that you can speak about the truth or so much you can say about the truth. The truth is pretty simple, really, and it's what I just said. And my books repeat this truth about the egoic mind and about the true self in different ways and go into it much more thoroughly. They point out what the ego's up to in the thought stream. So, for instance, it's full of judgments and it's full of comparisons. The more you realize what's in your thought stream, and that it's the ego's ploy to keep you involved and to continue the sense of I'm not good enough, or the sense of my life is lacking, or there's something wrong here. All of the thoughts are designed to keep you involved with it, to create a problem, and then try to fix that problem from the level of the ego. And its solutions are poor. Its problems are made up, and its solutions are poor. Its solutions are mostly about get more money, get someone to love you, get fixed. It's the wrong, so the solutions aren't there. And so people go round and round with the mind. The mind creates a problem, it makes them feel bad, then they have a terrible problem they have to fix. They have to fix themselves somehow, they have to get more money, they have to look more beautiful, they have to work out, they have to do this, do that, to try to fix themselves, because their mind made them feel bad about themselves. If the mind didn't say the things that it does, where would they be? They would be fine. It's mostly we create our own suffering in what we say to ourselves and about life and about other people. And, you know, someone might say, oh, but I've got people around me who tell me I'm fat or tell me I'm not good enough or whatever. And I would say, dump them. Because, you know, they're lost in their egoic mind, too.
Yeah.
You know, any kind of negativity that comes from people is coming from their own ego. They're caught in their own suffering, and it's spreading to you. So, you know, this is the human condition. The human condition is everyone is suffering with a negative mind, and we're hurting each other with a negative mind. It's a terrible situation. So we have to stop hurting ourselves and then, you know, do what we can to help others stop hurting themselves and stop hurting us. But if you can't do anything about that, then find some other people who are trying to lead a loving life instead of a hurting life. And, you know, there is a way out. You don't listen to your egoic mind, and you don't listen to other people's egoic minds. You just don't accept that in your life. I don't have anybody in my life like that. Yeah. I haven't for years and years. Why would I spend my energy and time with people like that?
Yeah, I don't either.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, and that's loving yourself, isn't it? That's just a natural thing. It isn't being judgmental. You don't have to be judgmental to just to make a good, healthy choice.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like it's just natural. There was a time when my boyfriend was very jealous, way before I was on the spiritual path, very jealous, and I stayed with him, and we had huge fights, and it was awful. And then there was a period of time, he was still my boyfriend, but we were apart for a number of years. He was living in one city, and I was living in another, and I was on the spiritual path, and a lot of things happened. And then we came back to being in the same city again. And when we came back together, I saw his jealousy start to rise up again. I think I said something, you know what? I'm just not going to be in a jealous relationship. So, you're going to have to either let go of the jealousy or it's over. And even though he is not on the spiritual path, he let go of the jealousy. So it didn't continue to be a problem. But there was something in me that just wasn't willing to go around with that again.
And that's an example of how we can raise each other up.
Yeah.
Because when someone is in love, when two people are in love, they're often willing to transform. They might be. There's so many examples when it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, when people won't change. But there certainly are those examples when people raise each other up, when they can grow together. And that's a really wonderful thing when that happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Okay, so I was going to ask you questions about different states of mind. So let's say that my state of mind then is I've actually gone through a lot of letting go of conditioning. I don't have the negative thinking that I used to have. But I don't really, you know, I can't really describe myself as happy either. I seem to just be kind of in this, you know, I don't know, this blah, flat space. I don't know what to do with myself.
Is this your actual experience?
No. I'm making up stories based on people that I know. Yeah.
Well, it kind of depends. I'm not sure that I have enough information, but certainly, I'm wondering if you're getting at how I talked about after awakening, I moved into a flat space.
That's an example. I've known other people that have done that. Like they just don't, you know, like they don't know what to do anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. After awakening, after my year of a honeymoon period, I had about 4 years of feeling, I guess the ego was trying to reconstellate. And there was a part of me that felt sad that I couldn't do drama anymore. Hmm. I'm a 4 on the Enneagram. And I think I was a bit of a drama queen. And there was a part of me that was sad that I couldn't go into drama anymore. And that missed the drama, the juiciness of having a problem. And so there was just a sense of, now what, so what?
Yeah, that's it. Now what, so what? Everything's meaningless, some people say.
Yeah, it felt really flat. It felt really dry. And it was a 4-year period, and I did not channel during that period, which was so strange. I didn't teach, and I didn't write. All of the things that had been so meaningful prior to awakening, I stopped doing. So I would have never expected that would ever happen to me. I had no sense of where I was going forward. I had no sense of the future. It was a very dry, flat time of just not knowing and not having any not much motivation either.
Yes.
And this is a very common stage after awakening. It's very common because I think we need to learn how to move from this place of awakeness. We're not familiar with how to move outside of our mind, telling us what to do. You know, most people, and before awakening, most people move according to what their mind tells them to do. Okay, now do this. Oh, now I have to, they go down their to-do list and they do what the mind tells them to do. You know, their mind says, oh, okay, now we have to do this and now we have to do that. And when you stop having that be what determines what you do, then you have to discover the other way to move in life, which is much quieter. There's no thoughts that cause that movement. There's just a spontaneous moving in the world, a spontaneous acting, a spontaneous speaking. And so you're just learning to do that, really.
Okay.
And it's subtler. And I think that there's also probably some really deep things going on after awakening that we don't even understand on energetic levels in the subtle body, things that are falling away and being reworked or rewired or changed in some way that we're not sure of, and all we're experiencing is this kind of flatness. But I'm sure that there are lots of things that are going on really deep levels. You know, this is all such a mystery, the whole spiritual unfoldment.
Yeah.
It's so mysterious.
Yeah, but what I heard you say, which is really helpful, is that if a person is experiencing this, then, you know, what might have happened is that, again, like you said, they were very dependent on the mind before, and now they can't be anymore. But the cultivation of that other form of movement, of feeling that and knowing that and flowing with that, hasn't yet developed. And so maybe if they needed a direction, a goal, it would be to start looking for that and sensing that a little bit, noticing when it's present and allowing it to thrive.
Yes. I've described this place as kind of an in-between place where I had one foot in the old me still and one foot in the new me. And so I don't think I had a deep enough experience of essence in the present moment to really fully delve in and know what that was like. I think I only had a taste of it when I woke up. I wasn't deep enough in it. I wasn't deep enough into presence, into that awakeness. I didn't know it intimately enough to want to be in it and to go deeper into it. So I was kind of stuck in between one world and the other for a while until that presence deepened some.
Yeah. So probably, and you talked about this, you talked about the experience you had of an ego identity, I'm awake, that happened. You know, based on what you're saying, as I'm putting it all together, it sounds like that ego identity of I'm awake can be a stumbling block in that. Again, there's more developing that needs to happen. Maybe you need to become like a new kind of student. You know, Jesus called it being born again, right? You're you're in a new life. You have to learn how to walk a new way. And so instead of having this idea or allowing this idea, I'm awake, it's maybe better to see yourself. I think Adyashanti once used the word, somebody told him he was a Buddha baby now.
Yeah.
You know? And see, okay, now I'm new. I got to learn how to live all over again and allow yourself to be a student again, but a student of something different.
Yeah, at the time, I didn't fully appreciate how awakening was really just the beginning, the
right.
bare beginning of this very lengthy path to full enlightenment, which is very rare for anyone to attain. But it's a very lengthy path that comes after awakening. And now that I'm 16 years down, a little further down the path, I have a better sense of what the path is.
Well,
and how what's involved in it and how long it is.
Well, and what you're saying is very important because it seems like there's a cultural idea right now that awakening is, you know, done. Right? Now I've achieved, I'm there. And again, it's not done, it's shift to a new level, a new beginning, a new level of growth, and to embrace it in that way rather than seeing, okay, now I'm done, I'm it.
Oh yeah, it's not at all done. But I would say that there is something so profoundly important about that permanent shift of identity, which is how I define awakening. I know some people just define it more loosely, but that permanent shift of identity to awakeness, to awareness, to presence is life-altering, and yet it is just the beginning of the further unfoldment towards enlightenment, but it is a huge transformation.
Okay, so let me ask you that question. So you just defined awakening very clearly in your vocabulary. What about enlightenment? Because you're talking about awakening as the beginning towards enlightenment. So what is enlightenment in your vocabulary?
Oh, that's a tough one. And I've only recently been even using that word because I didn't understand very much about this road between awakening and enlightenment until recently. And I'm starting to get a better picture of it. There is an awakening to awareness, to yourself as awareness. That's one stage. And as awakening to awareness is the experience that you are this awakeness, this awareness that's looking out of your eyes and seeing the beauty of the world and experiencing the beauty of life, and it's all good, and there's, you know, just a place of wonder and peace and love that naturally flows from this place. What I haven't gotten to that many people have experienced, maybe gotten a glimpse of or had a spiritual experience of, but is rare to my understanding, is a shift to being the absolute.
Yes.
Because this place of awakeness, there's still a certain duality of the awakeness and the world.
Yes.
At least in my experience. And as I've unfolded over these years, there's more and more unity with all of it, and more of a sense of unity with all of it. And it's like there isn't really a self anymore here, but there is a sense of the divinity in everything, and that there is only that. And yet, to be honest, I don't experience myself as that, as the source of everything yet.
Yeah, and you know what, Gina, I really, really deeply appreciate your honesty about these things, because these are things that I realize, and yet there's so many people today, as you know, it's like I would call it the ego in awakening. I don't know what else you can call it. And it's just so nice to hear someone speaking very, very honestly about where they are. Here is the awakening or the shift that I've experienced. Here's what's happening in this phase, and yet there's still this, you know, and I deeply appreciate that.
Well, I don't think that, thank you. I don't think that we can articulate this.
Yes.
Until we're farther down the road enough to articulate it. So I couldn't have said what I just said even just a few years ago.
Yeah.
So something has happened that's allowed me to articulate this. And so I think that's what happens is we only know what we've experienced. We don't know what we don't know.
Yes.
And so as you get farther down the road, you see what the map looks like better. And I'm still trying to figure it out. I'm interested in it and learning about it. And but yes, I that point where one knows for sure where one's identity lands, it actually wakes up into the absolute and lands there. I mean, it's one thing to sort of intellectually know yourself as the absolute or have an intuition of that or a sense of that, which I think I probably do. But I think there's another awakening where our identity wakes up as the absolute.
Yeah, I think.
And knows that it is the source of everything. And that's what I would call full enlightenment. And I think that's very rare.
Yeah, I think so too. My heart is just singing because I very, very seldom run across someone who shares this. And I'm really thrilled to hear it spoken. And you speak it very well and yet very simply. And I love it. Thank you.
Well, it's the first time I've ever spoken it.
Well, I'm glad you did it with me, Gina. I have a question on the board, so let me share this question. Is there a concern that you will leave the body and wake up in another body and have to go through awakening again?
In other words, am I concerned that I'm going to have to reincarnate again?
That's the way I interpret it, yes.
Not at all. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm supremely content and happy with my life. And if it's divine will for me to come back, I'm sure I would come back, and I'm sure I would come back with another mission of service, which is very gratifying. I've been given a wonderful life purpose in this lifetime. And so if I had to live another lifetime like this one, I would say fine, you know. In matter of fact, I might just volunteer and do that, who knows, because it is an amazing thing being a human being, and it takes really a great amount of courage to be a human being. It's really, really a trip. It's a head trip. The illusion is so convincing. The illusion that is created by the mind that we are this false self and that life is terrible and hard and untrustworthy and all, the whole illusory sense of the world and oneself is so convincing. And it's so gratifying to discover that it's an illusion and that the truth is so good. The truth is really good news. So if I had to come back and rediscover that again and teach that again, hallelujah. That's, you know, it's very cool.
Do you know a singer named Kirtana?
I do.
When I was watching you on Buddha at the Gas Pump and just now while listening to you, the same one of her songs came to me. It's a song she sings called I Said That I Would Sing. Do you know that song?
I don't.
I'll send you a link because you've reminded me of it twice. That's enough of a prompt for me. I'll send you a link, but yeah. It's a lovely song. Okay, so I have another question for you from the board. So you are not afraid of the trap of the ego? I guess, are you afraid that you'll sink back down, get pulled back in at all?
Oh, no. You know, once you've seen a lie, you can't be fooled again. It's like the rope and the snake metaphor that Ramana used. I believe it's Ramana.
Yes.
You know, once you see that the rope is a rope and not a snake, how can you be bothered by it? How could you be frightened of it? So, no, once you see a lie, it's done.
Yeah.
It's done. You can't be fooled again. So that's the great good news. That's the beautiful news. This is a really wonderful existence. There's only goodness behind it. And, you know, once you've seen that, you know it. You know it deeply, and nothing can bother you in the same way anymore.
So do we have any other questions? We only have about 11 minutes left with Gina. And so, again, if you have a question, this is a wonderful time. If someone asks a question and I missed it, You know, feel free to put it on the board again. I think it would be wonderful if somebody raised their hand so she'd know there's actually people here and I'm not making this up. There really are people here, but they're so quiet. Gosh, Jean, I don't know what else to ask. You've been a wonderful, wonderful guest. Is there anything that's popping into your mind that you would like to share?
Well, I want to say a little bit more about
this
great good news and what a wonderful life we're given, and how there really is just goodness behind it all. And, you know, when you get to that point where when you can see that, all you want to do is share that with others. You just want to say, hey, look at this. You know, look at the truth here. Look at reality. It's so beautiful. It's so wonderful. We're given so much. We're given everything that we need to be happy. And everything leads us to happiness. Everything leads us home. All of the suffering is there to lead us home. You know, it's the carrot and the stick. Life is constantly showing us which way to go through suffering. It's saying, no, don't go that way. Don't believe that thought. If you're suffering, you're believing the wrong thing. When you relax and are at peace, that's the truth. Whatever is going on in that moment, when you are relaxed and at peace and expanded, that's the truth. That's reality. Reality feels good. And when you follow reality, when you're in touch with reality, when you do what's true, according to what's arising in the real here and now, you're happy and it feels good. Life feels good. When you're following the egoic mind, life is suffering. And so life is showing us constantly and pointing us constantly in the direction towards home. And so it must be it can only be goodness behind life that does that.
Yeah.
Because home is good, and it's showing us. Even the suffering is the way it's showing us.
Yeah, so I had an image as you were speaking. It's like we're walking down a path, this wonderful grassy path. We're barefoot, and the grass feels good. But if we start to wander off the path, there's thorns. And that's to say, hey, you just got off the path. And so the best thing to do, instead of going deeper into the thorns, is to turn around as soon as possible and get back on the path and just keep following that path of joy.
Yeah, keep following the joy. Yeah, and that's something I write about a lot. Besides writing about how to see through the egoic mind and the ego's tricks, how to really get to know, it's helpful to get to know what the ego does and what kind of thoughts are in that thought stream and what that's all about. So that's part of it, but that's not all of it, because if we're just going to detach from the egoic mind or just be observing our mind all the time, just witness our mind, we're still involved with the mind. You know, the point of witnessing our mind is so that we can actually fall back into the truth, into essence, into the present moment. The reason for getting to know our mind and detaching from it is so that we can actually experience our true self. So that's the second part of this. Learn to detach from your mind, but don't stop there. See what else is here and get to know it really deeply.
Yeah.
You know, before I said I was, I felt like I was with one foot in and one foot out of, or one foot in each world. Well, that second part of this equation is to get to know the present moment, get to know the true self that shows itself in the present moment, and go deeper and deeper and deeper into presence. And then, you know, you'll find out how delicious that is, how rewarding, how full and complete that experience is, and you won't have any interest whatsoever in going back to the mind.
So
there's two parts of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let go of the false and embrace the true. Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, those are the two things that I write about is, well, how do we get into the present moment? And what is this present moment all about? And why get into the present moment? The reason to get into the present moment is that all of your wisdom is right there, accessible, and that will show you how to live this life.
Hmm. All right, we do have another question on the board. The question is, how did you learn your purpose for this life?
I think everyone's purpose is shown to them moment to moment. All we can know is what is true to do right now. And whatever is true to do right now is going to be part of your life purpose. Maybe you won't be able to see the biggest picture of what your life purpose is for decades. You know, so it's easy for me to see it now because I'm 64 years old. So I can look back and I know what it is now, pretty much. But there's still life ahead, so who knows, you know, how it might modify or unfold going forward. But we don't necessarily get to know the biggest picture of it until we do.
So can worrying about life purpose possibly be a trap in some cases then?
Sure, yeah. I write a lot about life purpose, and I've noticed that people will get hung up and suffer over, I'm not doing my life purpose.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as you are aligned with your heart and following your heart to the best of your ability, you're doing your life purpose. And at some point, you'll probably get a sense of what that is. But it's also true that many people have life purposes that aren't apparent and may never be apparent. It might be a life purpose like just learning to love more. You know, and that won't be apparent as something you do in the world. A lot of people's life purposes are not something they do in the world. It's going to be some character that quality of character that they're building, or maybe it's a talent that they're developing. So, you know, people have a very grandiose idea of life purpose.
Yeah. That's what I'm hearing you say. A life purpose could be very subtle and mm-hmm. and very important. So, you know, stop mm-hmm. looking for, you know, I should be channeling.
Yeah.
Like, aren't I channeling? And maybe, you know, I need to let go of hating myself so much in this lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, who knows what the soul wants, but whatever it is the soul will find ways to make that happen and make you more and more aware of that and bring that about. I think it's fairly rare that people don't accomplish their life purpose to some extent or to some degree. So I think it's almost inevitable. As an astrologer, I talk a lot about life purpose with people, and but the chart is designed to bring about the life purpose. There are drives that are instilled in each person to bring about the life purpose. So whatever you're driven to do and whatever your talents are going to be part of your life purpose. You can't help but do it. That's more great good news, right?
Yeah, and it'd be nice just for, you know, especially if you're suffering over, I don't know my life purpose, to trust that I must be doing it even if I'm not aware. And when you make that shift in the mind, the suffering's going to stop. So that's going to show you stepped out of the thorns and back onto the grassy path. there is another question on the board. Is that all right with you? Because we're getting close to the closing time. All right, this question is, how do we learn to listen to our heart when we have been so attached to listening to the ego?
Well, I guess this is where meditation comes in. I don't know any other way to learn more quickly to detach from the mind than meditation. If you really are serious about learning to quiet the mind so that you can listen to the heart, then get serious about a daily practice of meditation. Because without a daily practice of meditation, it could take you lifetimes. I don't mean that person personally, of course. But it's just that it's very, this conditioning, this programming is very strong. It's not that easy to break out of it. And meditation is a very efficient way of doing that. And it will speed things up in a way like nothing else. It's very hard for people to detach from their mind without a practice of meditation. So I hear that all the time with my clients will often say, oh, but I'm so, my thoughts are so hard to not listen to. And then I say, do you meditate? And they say, no. And so I say, aha. Well, so, you know, of course, you can't expect to not listen to your mind if you don't meditate.
Yeah, and I want to redefine meditation. You can agree with me or disagree, but you know, meditate is just a word, and based on what I heard you say earlier, so I'm interpreting what I heard you say, which is why you can correct me. Meditation is really the practice of not listening to the mind.
Yes, it's the practice of focusing the mind on something other than the thought stream.
Yes.
On a sound, on a sensation. Sounds, sensations, sights, anything that's coming through your five senses or your sixth sense is reality. And what's the thought stream is the creator of the illusory reality.
Right.
So whenever you're paying attention to something that is not the thought stream, you're in reality. And so meditation is a practice of focusing on some sensory component, usually. The breath, the feeling of the breath going in and out of the nose, you know, that's a sensory experience. Or counting the breaths, that will focus the mind so you can't count your breaths or focus on your breath and think what's in your thought stream at the same time. So that's all we're trying to do with meditation is give the mind something to do that's in the real here and now, focusing in reality so that it's not lost in the thought stream.
Yeah.
And then you get a bodily experience of what it's like to be in the here and now. And this is very valuable. You have to bodily experience, get familiar with what it feels like to be in presence instead of lost in thought. The more time you spend in presence, the more you make yourself ready for awakening. The more you lay the groundwork for awakening, spending more and more time in presence. See, the really good news is that you don't have to wake up to be happy and to experience awakeness. You can experience awakeness anytime you drop out of your mind and just let yourself be present in the moment. Then you're awake. So everybody knows what awakeness is. Everybody already knows what it is because everyone spends, maybe it's a fraction of a second, but many people spend seconds or more in this awake place. People who meditate spend a lot of time in this awake place. That's what it feels like to be awake. It's not some more altered or mysterious state after awakening. Presence is presence before awakening or after awakening. It's the same presence. It just becomes more established after awakening. That becomes where you live from. But you can experience presence before awakening and be as happy and present and loving and peaceful as someone who's awake. So it doesn't matter if you wake up or not in this lifetime. You can spend more and more time in presence by just practicing that. And you practice it by meditating.
Yeah, and I think what you just said is really worth repeating. Sometimes, as you know, another thing that's popular today is to say that you don't need spiritual practice. And I guess if you aren't happy, you do need spiritual practice.
Most people need spiritual practice.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's just another ego trick that's getting spread around in the spiritual community that you don't need practice.
I think it's one of the most damaging things that Advaita form of spirituality puts out there.
Yeah.
It's very misleading. And it's very rare that somebody who's never practiced wakes up and stays stable in that. See, that is the difference, is that there are a lot of people who wake up, but whether they stay stable in it or not, and how deeply that awakeness is lived in their life, depends on how much they meditated and did their healing work before awakening. So you have to establish a ground. There has to be a certain clarity within the body-mind for this awakeness to be able to take hold and deepen. So.
Well, thank you. You really have been a wonderful guest, and I know that everyone in the room appreciates it. I do see people saying thank you and posting little pictures of hands clapping and stars and hearts and and all of that. And I will be emailing you. In fact, if you hold on just 1 second, I'll let go of the mic, and then I'll come back and say a personal goodbye. So, everyone, I'm going to let go of the mic now, so whoever needs to take it next can. And I will be back in 25 minutes. So see you soon.